Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12 is a familiar verse. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. So it is with the wisdom of humans, with our imaginations, with our making plans and establishing purposes. In our own minds, we can justify a lot of things, and things seem right to us, and we can make a case for them very easily. But God says what's important is his agenda, his purposes that will stand for all time, and what he has revealed that is truth, and that that stands as opposed to what we might prefer or what might seem good to us. I think this lesson this morning has a lot to teach us regarding expediency. Just a definition of expediency. Expediency, when you make decisions driven by expediency, you're driven by what seems convenient, by what you judge to be practical, by what you determine will accomplish the end goal that you're looking for. And so you're going to choose this course instead of that course because you think it's going to work out the way that you think would have the best possible results. So it's really just another way to say that the end justifies the means. And this concept of expediency, it drives decisions in so much of the world today. I mean, I think of the business world, and I think how many decisions all day long are driven by expediency. Now, that might be okay in cases where there's not a distinction between what's morally right and you're just making wisdom decisions. Certainly, there's cases in the scriptures where we're pointed to make decisions because of, on a wisdom basis, this is what's going to work out right. And so there are cases like that. But when you're in a situation where there's a distinction drawn between here is the way of conviction, here is the way of principle, here is the way of divine revelation and truth, here is the way of morality. When you have that choice versus here is the way of expediency, if I choose this, I think it'll work out right. If I choose the other way, I don't like so much the prospects that it looks to me like that's going to give me. That's where really the rubber meets the road on this this message that we're going to hear this morning about expediency. The one example from my work life that probably stands out to me the most, back many days ago, many years ago, when I worked for the construction company, we were having an open house, and this is my week of open houses, so open houses come to my mind readily. We have two coming up this week. But this was in Upper Marlboro. You might have seen the Alban facility that's right off the Beltway. It's right at the exit. If the trees were cut down, it would have visibility to the Washington, D.C. Beltway over there, but exit 11 or whatever off the Beltway. We built this lavish palace. I think we were better at lots of times at building things maybe than we were at selling things. We just loved to build great buildings. We never were able to fully utilize both floors of this building, how expansive it was, because it cost so much to heat and air condition the place. That, in fact, they ended up by now, a couple of years ago, they ended up selling off half of it to another company because it was just more than we needed. But this was going to be a spectacular open house, and as the marketing manager, I was in charge of hosting this and arranging it. And the big draw, we were giving away a brand new Caterpillar skid steer loader. Now, this isn't some little toy. This is, you know, in the $25,000 to $30,000 range that this would cost. We had Caterpillar contributing, and we had our company contributing in. And so there was a lot of play given in all of our advertisement. Come, put your business card in, you know, we'll have a drawing, and we'll have this free giveaway. Well, we get down to the day of the event, and all of a sudden, the vice president of sales, he puts a lot of pressure on me, and he says, "Now, Paul," he says, "I hope you understand that we want this skid steer loader to go to somebody who's worthy. You know, it better not be some little small-time player that doesn't have any opportunity for us in our future business. You know, you better have screened these things out, you know, when you put the." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "You know," so I said, "you know, given my relationship to the Lord, you know, I'm not going to. There's no way that I'm going to be dishonest in how we handle this drawing here. This is our big focal public thing." I was just shocked. I mean, he was adamant that there was some way I'm supposed to screen these down and direct it. Of course, he does that, you see, in little ways throughout his whole life. He's been doing this whole life in terms of making decisions on this basis. So if he has a trade show booth and he's giving away something small, he sorts through the cards probably and, you know, steers it one way or the other. That's just a regular way of operating. So now he's putting, you know, he's putting all this. So I'm just praying to the Lord. Well, we're going down the path we need to go down. This is an example of expediency, or, you know, it's so clear. There's no doubt about what the right thing to do is. So it comes down, and we have the drawing. I see I'm sweating again already. So we have the drawing, and pick out this card. It's a company I've never heard of. I mean, I've never even heard of this guy. And I said, oh, no. So I go, and of course, he's the sales VP. He's livid already. So I go back in on the computer, you know, and type in this guy's name. Well, his address isn't even in our territory. His address is down in North Carolina somewhere is where this guy's. I think not only is he some small fry, he's not even in our territory. So now he's already in the ear of the owner, you know, talking up what a bad thing I've done and how he gave counsel and how this has gone south, et cetera, et cetera. And so now I've got the two of them together, the owner, and I don't want to impugn the owner. It wasn't his, you know, intention in terms of going down this path. So anyway, the vice president, he didn't like me anyway, you know. So he's using this, you know, and I'm saying he's going to make a lot of hay out of this. So I said, hold on just a minute. I said, we haven't administered given the gift. Let's call the guy up. Let's see who he is. You know, we don't know that much about him. Well, we call the guy up. We award him the skid steer. And in God's sovereignty, it turns out that who he was a subcontractor for our biggest customer, didn't want the skid steer loader, didn't need it for what he was doing, was happy to work out a deal with our largest customer in terms of letting him have the benefit of the new skid steer loader for other amenities that he could provide to this customer. And everybody was happy, and it was like this huge turnaround. I thought, you know, just what a testimony to God's grace, to God's sovereignty. Now, there's all kinds of different examples. I mean, you know, other examples are where you go down the wrong path, and yet you see that God can still, in his sovereignty, he can still bring about good, even when we bumble and stumble and we make sinful mistakes that aren't even so, it's not like we're consciously wanting to sin so much. It's just the pressure of a situation leads us down a path, and then one step leads to another, and all of a sudden we're way out of bounds. We didn't start way out of bounds, but we ended up way out of bounds. And yet God can overrule those situations. So divine sovereignty always trumps human expediency. God's sovereign purposes cannot be derailed by man's sinful blunders. Even though Abraham is going to make a couple of decisions here out of expediency, and decisions that are clearly wrong, we're going to see how God rescues him, how God rescues Sarah. We're going to see how God, in the end, is able to still accomplish his purposes, remain faithful to his promises. What's at stake in this story? There's some big things at stake here. This isn't a small little skid steer loader that doesn't have a lot of consequences in eternity. You know, what you have at stake here is the divine promise that he's going to bless Abraham and his wife Sarah through having children born to them, of which one will end up being in the line of the seed of the Messiah, who will come to be the ultimate deliverer for mankind. And so there's a lot at stake in Abraham and Sarah having a child, and in this child developing and continuing to go on down the line until you get to the Messiah. So we're going to look first of all, the first verses 10 to 13. Pressure can lead to expediency. That's how it is in our lives. As we get into pressure-type situations and we end up making sinful decisions because of the pressure, we end up giving in to expediency, and we end up doing things that might seem borderline, but really are wrong in terms of the choice. So we're going to look at two of these decisions here that Abraham makes. The first decision, in verse 10, it says, "Now there was a famine in the land." This is the particular pressure problem that comes to bear on Abram. Now you can put yourself in Abram's position and imagine what his expectations were. Here God had made all of these gracious promises to him about the land that he was going to give to him, and how he was asking Abram to make all these sacrifices, to leave a place of security and comfort, to leave Ur, where he had grown up, Ur of the Chaldees, to even leave Haran after his father had died. He'd gone through the stress and the tedious dangers of this long journey. He had had to leave, you know, wait for his father to pass away and then continue on the journey. He'd been faithful to the call of God. He's commended in Hebrews for his faith, not knowing the land that God was to give, not knowing what the future would hold. He's done all these things. Now when he gets to the land, and of course he's traveled through the land, starting in the north, down to the south, and now he's pitched his tent, he's built his altar, he's sacrificed. Certainly his expectation is, God, you are ready to bless me with something really huge. For these sacrifices, for everything that's taken place, he must have had a high level of expectation. But what did he find? He found that the Canaanites were in the land. These enemies that were terrible, that were pagan again in their culture, that were going to fight in opposition to him. They weren't just going to cede the land over to him. They weren't there with welcoming arms to say, hey, God told us you were coming to take this land. We have it all dusted off for you and cultivated and, you know, we're all ready for it. No, you've got enemies that you're going to have to fight in order to take possession. Okay, Abram didn't back down from that. He didn't turn and run, you know, back to Ur. He hangs in there, but now immediately upon arriving, all of a sudden he's beset with this trial that comes from the sovereign hand of God. This famine that comes up and is going to threaten his very existence and that of his family and his household and all the people that had come with him, these proselytes, the ones he preached to. He told them how wonderful God was. He built God up to be what a tremendous God who stands by his people. And now look what's happening. They had come from a land by the Euphrates River that was always fertile, that always had plenty of water. Water was never an issue for them back where they had come from. And here, they come to a land, and whatever their expectations had been, they're finding them to be great stress in this particular situation. And isn't that how it is with God? You know, it's not always, hey, God has a wonderful plan for your life, and everything's going to go all rosy, you know? Or it's not always like Joel Osteen's book titles, you know, the best life now, the next great you, or whatever the things are. It's interesting. I saw he's diverted his focus into some marketing ventures now he and his wife are going into, but that's another story. So here, what you have is the harsh reality that God, in his sovereign purposes, one of the ways he works is to test our character, to test our resolve and our faith as to whether we're really committed to him and what he said, whether we really have a concept of his character where we think he's a good God, whether we really are tied into the relationship that we have with God so that we can trust him in hard times. And so you might come from a mountaintop spiritual experience, but the next thing you might have thrown in your way is a trial, is something that's very severe and very difficult to withstand. And so it is with Abram. Now, I think this is a spiritual trial, and so I don't think it's any neutral decision that he's making here. I think he's making a negative moral choice to basically, without seeking God's counsel, without inquiring of God what he should do, on his own initiative, he comes up with the way that seems right to a man. And he says, I'm taking my family and we're bailing. Okay, we're getting out of here, getting out of Dodge as fast as we can because I hear there's food down in Egypt. Now, I know that's going to another pagan culture. I know that's going to a savage type of an area, and yet I prefer that to hanging around and seeing what God's going to do next in this land, because so far it hasn't been that great. And anyway, I think God will appreciate the help I'm giving him, because there's these promises that God has made. If he's going to fulfill these promises, Sarah and I got to stay alive, and if we're going to stay alive, we need some food. I think I'll help God out a little bit. I'm interested in the promises. I'm committed to the promises. But I'm going to come up with my own agenda of really how to help that. So remember, this land that he's leaving, this land was the promised land. This land was the land of blessing. This land was the land God had given to Abram and his descendants forever. How could you leave a land that's characterized by that? That's really going against God's promises. So that's the problem. That's the pressure point. And we can imagine that if we were under that kind of pressure, you know, maybe most of us would have responded as Abram did. I mean, Abram, we're like Abram. And Abram, he felt the pressure, and he bowed to the pressure, and instead of seeking God's counsel, here he's fleeing to Egypt. So he comes up with this expedient solution. You got the pressure point, then you have the expedient solution. He goes down to Egypt to sojourn there. Now, sojourn is a very important word because we see his mentality is not to live there forever. His mentality is, look, this is a temporary situation. As soon as possible, I'm going to pull back my stakes up and I'm going to hustle right back to the promised land. I'm just going down here because in terms of expediency, it's necessary for me to do this in order to sustain our family. There's no other choice that I can see because, again, I'm bound in my thinking by natural solutions rather than omnipotence of God, rather than anything that God can do in terms of the impossible. So he goes down to Egypt, and understanding that, hey, this is a place that's still going to be characterized by idolatry and a pagan culture, and it just exposes his lack of faith. You know, he had the same situation. Sarah was barren. He didn't leave Sarah. You know, he didn't say, well, I'm going to get myself in it. Well, he did later on say, well, I'll try a different avenue. But at this point, he's not saying, well, I'm ditching Sarah. So why would you bail out of the promised land? That just shows me that it's a wrong choice that he's making here, and one that God is going to have to respond to. Again, God's purposes aren't going to be set aside just because Abraham sort of blunders around in his failure of his faith here. So he goes down and he seeks this sustenance there in Egypt. And I think how much this is like us. How much do we have that tendency to bail when hard times come, whether it's in our job situations, I just need to get out of this, rather than, God, what are you trying to teach me in the midst of this? How do you want to build my testimony through this? What do you want to accomplish? Not that it's always God's will that we stay in the same job forever, but just we need to seek what God's counsel is. What does God want us to do? Not there's pressure, so the expedient thing is I need to bail. There's pressure in the relationship, so I'm going to get out of the relationship. There's pressure in this, so I'm going to just run away. I'm going to always run away. As if God can't put more pressure in our path and say, well, you didn't learn the lesson back then. I'm going to double the lesson, make it a little bit harder, and we're going to have it right down the path right ahead of you. That's what God loves to do. He'll take the same kind of situation, intensify it, and say, you didn't learn it when you should have learned it. Now you get to experience it again and hopefully learn it here. So he basically is justifying this decision. He has this reasonable rationalization. He says, for the famine was severe in the land. He can think it through and say, I can rationalize my decision. I have a basis upon which I can explain it and justify it to myself and justify it to others. And so this is this first decision he makes to flee the promised land and go down into Egypt. Now, the second rationalization decision, verses 11 to 13, is even more critical and has even more severe consequences to his family. And that's his decision to protect self at all costs. And so it says, though, here again, you have the same three types of items playing out. You have a pressure problem, you have an expedient solution, and then you have a reasonable rationalization, just like before. So the pressure problem is he realizes, you know, I'm going down to Egypt, and I've got this woman who's so beautiful for my wife, they're going to want her. And what does that mean for me? He's not thinking what it means for her, okay? Which, you know, from a role of a husband, this is pretty condemning. He's thinking, what does this mean for me? So I know your women are really going to have some issues with his thought process here. And I don't blame you. It says it came about when he came near to Egypt. So he got so far down the road before he even goes through this thought process. He hadn't thought through everything. When he went, made the decision to leave the promised land, he didn't think through all the contingencies and what was going to happen. You know, he's now halfway down the road, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, I better think about these things too. So his problem, this pressure problem, is he says to Sarah as well, he's very open with Sarah. I have to say, he's pretty honest with her. This is quite a conversation that he has with Sarah, right? He starts out on a good note. He says, so I know that you are a beautiful woman. Well, that's a good note, okay, for a husband. I mean, she's 65, Abram's 75. Now, of course, 65 in their lifespan would be more like the 30s and 40s in terms of our lifespan. But the phrase that's used here and that's repeated in terms of how beautiful, apparently she's exceptionally beautiful. She's a knockout, even at age 65 here. And she's in a culture, it's not like she's there in her bikini on the beach and sex texting or whatever. I mean, she's not putting herself out there. She's dressed very modestly, you know, and yet You cannot hide how beautiful a woman this is. And here she's paired up with this 10-year older guy who's maybe not the most handsome guy, you know. And he said, well, we're heading into Egypt. They're going to sort of check us out. And they're gonna just be knocked over by how beautiful you are, Sarah. And this is what's going to happen. He says, I can just see the way this is going to play out. He says, it's going to come about when the Egyptians see you that they'll say, boy, that's his wife. So he's the impediment for us to possessing Sarah for our wife. She already has a husband. So what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of the husband. They're going to kill me, but they'll let you live. Well, that's great for you, Sarah, but that's not so great for me. And, of course, his rationale here seems to be all about what's good for Abram, not so much about what's good for Sarah. So he's thinking through this pressure problem, and he comes up with this expedient solution very quickly. It just comes to his mind, and it's not even that much of a reach for him because there's a half-truth here. I'm sure he doesn't even think that he's really lying so much here. It's just I'm not going to tell him the whole truth. You know, I'm going to say, look, all you need to do, Sarah, is just say you're my sister, and that'll change the whole landscape of the situation, and that'll be so much better if we can just package it up that way, if you'll just say that you're my sister, which, of course, she is, again, the half-sister of Abram. But look at his motivation here, this rationalization. I mean, this is a very disturbing motivation. He says, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of whatever happens to you, if that happens to you, but I'm going to be fine. What do you think about that, Sarah? You know, and this must have been quite a conversation that they had. Now, Sarah, of course, later in the scripture, is commended for her obedience. And yet there are ways, I mean, certainly the Lord does not, even though the husband is the head of the home, the Lord's not calling on wives to submit to situations that are immoral or situations that go against divine truth. This is a difficult situation here that Sarah is presented with. But what's pointed out to me that I wouldn't have seen on my own, some commentators have said that part of his reasoning here that maybe is behind the scenes is that in this culture, if you have a brother and sister situation, that maybe in order for them to consummate the marriage with the woman, there would be, you know, a dowry that would have to be paid. There would be a sort of a negotiation with the brother in order to finally take the sister to be the wife, that there might be some time intervening. And maybe Abram's thinking that, well, this will give me a little bit of time at least. If this situation develops this way, if it happens this way, you know, maybe I can still rescue things, we can get some food, and maybe we can still escape. I don't know if that would be putting the best possible light on the situation if he's thinking that way. But that's not how it works out, as we're going to see in verses 14 to 15. Expediency compromises genuine faith. Expediency cannot account for every contingency. See, when we're making plans, we don't have that full-orbed omniscience that God has. We can't take everything into consideration. That's why we saw that Abram, he didn't even take this into consideration until he got halfway down the path, and he doesn't know how this is going to play out. So expediency, what it ends up doing, even though it seems good to us, it seems so attractive, it seems like this will work, this will be the way out of whatever the dilemma is, expediency, it compromises genuine faith, because now we're walking by sight, we're walking by our own resources, we're walking by works, we're walking by what we can do to pull ourselves out of the situation. We're not walking by faith. We're not waiting upon God for his solution. We're not looking to him and being dependent upon him. So expediency, it always compromises genuine faith in these types of situations, and it cannot account for every contingency. So now we play out in verses 14 to 15, it takes these two problem situations where he came up with the expedient solutions, and now it plays them out. You just have the execution of these two situations. So first of all, this first solution, it came about when Abram came into Egypt. So, okay, so that was his proposed solution to the famine. Due to the famine, okay, he did. He went down to Egypt. And that probably seemed to work out okay, at least on the surface of it immediately. He gets out of the famine situation. He has access to food and water. And so at least on the surface of it, it seems like, well, maybe this is at least trend in the right direction in terms of how things are working out. I mean, it's interesting that when you go down a wrong path, you leave the straight and narrow, you don't see God throwing up all kinds of obstacles at you. You know, you don't see God closing doors and saying, I'm going to make it difficult for you to go down this wayward path. No, actually, that path tends to be fairly easy. There's no obstacles that are put in Abram's way. He has an easy journey, I think, down to Egypt. I think everything goes pretty smooth for him. Satan is licking his chops saying, man, this is exactly my will for Abram. He's right in the center of my will for Abram. And so he heads down there and he doesn't seem to have any difficulty. But it's just like we say, going from the frying pan into the fire. You know, he thought he was in a pickle. He thought he was in a difficult situation on the promised land. Well, now he's really in a difficult situation. And so now comes up this unforeseen contingency. As we get to the execution here of his second plan, as Sarah, you know, maintaining that they're just brother and sister. So as they execute this part of the plan, all of a sudden things don't go as planned. We have some unexpected circumstances. So it says, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Again, it cannot be emphasized too much that she is a knockout, okay? And the notoriety of her beauty reached all the way into Pharaoh's royal household. So apparently he had his upper henchmen that were on the lookout for who were the hottest women, because he wanted to add them to his harem. And so he had scouts out there. It's like a little NFL scouting expedition. You know, he's got his northeast, southwest scouts at work. And so when she comes into the region, all of a sudden, he's getting reports back. It says the Pharaoh's officials, they saw her and they praised her to Pharaoh. And so what happened was, here you have a situation where there's not going to be any room for negotiation, any time for negotiation. Pharaoh can take whoever he wants, whenever he wants. He doesn't ask for permission. He just sends his little henchman knocking on your tent door and says, Pharaoh has need of Sarah. Okay? Get your stuff together and we're leaving. And you have nothing to say in it. There's no argument. There's no discussion. It's just over in just the blink of an eye. And so that's what happened, is this woman now was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, that's the treatment of Sarah. That's what's happening to Sarah. And these are events that are now unfolding at breakneck speed. And Abram is left back sitting in his tent thinking, wow, what's happening now to Sarah? I thought maybe I'd have a chance maybe to rescue, maybe we'd get out. But now we're into this long-term situation that it looks like she's been taken in to be part of his harem, and now I'm left alone. Well, here's how Abram is treated, though. It says Pharaoh treated Abram well for her sake, because he was glad, he was thankful that he could add Sarah to his harem. So he gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. So these might have arrived, you know, maybe one day he gets this shipment in, and the next day, hey, here comes another load gets delivered. And how does Abram feel, you know, as he's sitting there, as he's listening to all these animals bleating? And it's not any sense of joy or excitement or gratitude on his part. He's now feeling the burden of the consequences of his own failure of faith and of the situation that he's put Sarah in. Now, as to whether, you know, this relationship ever gets consummated with Pharaoh, I mean, most of the commentators would say, well, they don't think so. I mean, when you read through the passage, it certainly seems that he takes her to be his wife. And yet, there's certainly a process that we know that goes on in these kinds of harem relationships. We look at the book of Esther and see how many months it takes, you know, as you have, basically, you get in line in the rotation, you know, before your number gets called and whatever. So you've got some time maybe that's involved here. And I think of the character of God, and I think of how he's able to protect Abram and now Sarah being the innocent party, really, in this. Certainly the expectation I would have is that God is able to protect Sarah in this instance. But Abram doesn't have any knowledge of this yet. And so Abram is here, and he's quite in a downcast state, even though he's being showered with all of this material blessing, because he's seeing the fruits of his expedient actions and decision-making and behavior, and how it is that he'd gotten offline with the Lord. And yet, verses 17 to 20, it's just an amazing statement of divine sovereignty and how it overrules human expediency. I mean, I can testify in my situation so many times, I can just testify to the sovereignty of God and how it's come up in special situations to just amaze me. Well, this is, goes even, of course, way beyond that by quantum leaps in terms of what God does here. How quickly God acts, how decisively he acts, and how he takes care of a mess. Man, we make a mess of things. We blunder in our sin and we mess it all up. And yet God, in his grace and in his mercy, comes and is able to rescue us, is able to restore us, is able to provide forgiveness. It's just amazing what God does for his people. And so here we see in verse 17 the protection of Sarah as God comes in divine judgment on Pharaoh and his house. It says, but the Lord, so the Lord was watching all this. It's not like he's unaware of what's happening to Sarah. He comes and he struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. I mean, it's a bad thing if you get hit with plagues. Okay. If you get hit with great plagues, if these great plagues are from the hand of God, are part of divine wrath and judgment, these great plagues are not pleasant. We all have our physical ailments that we've been talking about and things that distress us. It's nothing compared to when God says, I'm sending great plagues to get your attention and shake you up so that you no longer think that you're self-sufficient. You no longer have that arrogance and pride where you just do whatever you want and think that you're the only authority in the universe. No, I strike that all away from you, and you're on your knees groveling, you know, because you are in extreme pain. And so whatever took place, whether these are boils or some type of leprosy or skin infection or whatever happened, it was very painful. It was very uncomfortable, and it was very evident that it was not happening to Sarah. And that there's a distinction between what's happening in his household and somehow Sarah's in a different category. Now, whether Sarah had a discussion with Pharaoh, did Pharaoh interact with Sarah and say, hey, what's going on here? And it's, you know, I mean, why is it, you know, the terms of your brother, but he's my husband, he's not my brother. You know, did Sarah, was there some interaction that took place, or did Pharaoh have some soothsayers and some wise men that he brought in, and God allowed to speak through them the truth to Pharaoh to give him insight into, did he have nightmares and dreams of what was saying? Who knows exactly how he sorted this out? But the truth came to be known to Pharaoh that there was a direct relationship between him taking Sarah in to be part of his harem, and now he was going to treat her as his wife. There's a direct relationship in judgment upon what God was doing, and that God's desire was to rescue and to spare both Abram and Sarah. And so Pharaoh now is very upset. He knows that he's been deceived. He hasn't been treated fairly in this whole episode, even though he's an ungodly person. The assumption that Abraham made was that, well, Pharaoh and all the people in Egypt would be men of no integrity, would be men of viciousness, brutality, would be savages who would just kill and steal women and treat women like that. I mean, that was the assumption that he made, and the assumption was probably greatly, greatly true. And yet, you know, Pharaoh still is being somewhat mistreated here. And so he calls Abram into his presence, verse 18, and he issues this rebuke. You have this very strange sight where the man of God who's been called by God, has God's blessing set upon him, is indistinct from all the nations of the earth. He's set in this special place, and yet Pharaoh is going to be in the position of rebuking Abram. It's like somebody said, it's like Putin, you know, sitting in judgment on the United States and lecturing us about human rights and freedom. And then you think, who are you? You know, what kind of moral platform do you have to be? Not that we have that great a moral platform either, but who, you know, so whatever. So you look at this contrast here, and you have this strange dialogue taking place. So this word of rebuke, Pharaoh calls Abram and he says, what is this that you have done to me? In other words, you have mistreated me. You've done something to me that I didn't deserve. Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Well, I don't think Abraham blurted out because you're such a savage. I knew you would kill me. No, I don't think, again, Abraham's going to come with the full truth here. I think this is a good time to shut up and just listen at this point. So he goes on, why did you say she's my sister so that I took her for my wife? And, of course, these are all rhetorical questions. He's not looking for an answer. He by now has figured out the situation. He knows that it's deception. It's expedient reasoning on the part of Abram's part. And Abram's just come up with this plan to try and save his own skin. But how humbling this is to Abram, this embarrassment in front of of Pharaoh. Certainly embarrassment in front of his wife. I don't know what this did to their marriage relationship in terms of what kind of conversations they had down the road after this, because he's going to have continued instances that we're going to see. This is how the Bible presents the flaws of even the heroes of the faith, even the ones that are presented to us as the examples in Scripture. They are flawed characters, and the Bible doesn't whitewash their sins and their just the blame that they have in different situations. So this is a down point for Abram's life. So he gives this command, this by way of dismissal, but it's really also the way by which God's going to rescue in his sovereignty. God is using Pharaoh here to rescue Sarah and Abram from this situation. So Pharaoh now commands, he says, now then, okay, here's his determination. You know, after I've had these plagues that have been afflicted on me, here's your wife, take her and go. Not only that, Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him. He gave him this royal escort. You know, you've got, you know, you straightway, we're going to make full speed to get you to the border and get you out of here. We're not going to waste any time. We're not messing around. The fear of God is upon Pharaoh now and his royal household. And he's saying, I'm going to give you quick passageway down to the border, and I want you to head back up north to the Negev and back up into the Promised Land. So they escorted him away with his wife, and this is an interesting statement, and all that belonged to him. Pharaoh's not taking back all those gifts. He's saying, I'm not going to mess with the details. You know, I'm not so concerned with the fact that I lavished all these expensive presents upon Abram. You keep all that stuff. I don't want to touch any of it. I just want to be rid of the whole situation, you know, as quickly as possible, because I know the capabilities of this God that I'm dealing with. I don't want to anger him or disturb him any more than I already have. And so he just says, hey, just go everything. Just get out of here. I don't want you, don't come back. You know, you don't have any invitation to come back. We're kicking you out, and we don't want you ever to come back. And so this is the point where God takes over and renews and restores his relationship with Abram and Sarah. And you have this rescue leading to the repentance, I'm sure, on the part of Abram and Sarah, because it leads to a renewal of worship. And that's where we close up with verses 1 to 4 of chapter 13, which again just ties the section together with what we had seen. Now they're back to their starting point, but they come back as different people because they've gone through some experiences. They didn't successfully go through a trial and trust God through the trial, but they went through a trial and were humbled by it and were embarrassed by it and were driven to their knees in repentance by it, so that they did come to a more mature level of dependence upon God at the point where they come back and now they renew their worship, having been sanctified, having been cleansed, and knowing that God is gracious with them, being thankful for all that God's provided in terms of all this abundance that he comes back into the promised land with. And so it says that there's this starting point. He gets back to the starting point. Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him. And again, Lot's still tagging along because he's there for the rest of chapter 13. So he's like an appendage, that nothing really significant has happened yet with Lot, except we know that he's along for the ride. And then we're going to get to the situations next week dealing with Lot. So we want to know that Lot's there because we're getting ready to introduce him. But it's important to see that Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and gold, that by the grace of God, he was enriched at the expense of Pharaoh, at the expense of the world. God just overruled the whole situation and worked it out for his good, as he says that he will do. And then Abram and Sarah, they're refocused now on the mission that God has called them to. And these three characteristics that you see throughout the book of Genesis are the characteristics when Abram is in fellowship with God. What he does is he pitches his tent, he worships at the altar, and he calls on the name of the Lord. Always look for those three characteristics in the book of Genesis. He pitches his tent, his pilgrim mentality. So he has his tent there where it had been at the beginning. He worships at the altar. He's now cleansed. He's fit for worship. This is the same altar that he had made there formerly. So now he's returned and he's offering up sacrifices at this altar. And thirdly, he's calling on the name of the Lord. He's combining his worship with witness and with the proclamation of the character of God. I'm sorry.
Fire alarm.